woke up this morning with the sun down shining in.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut through the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sun down.
Well, don't pick Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tamar. We got Ricky on the board. SP Futures up 2. NASDAQ Futures up 13. They're up more than that last night. They've come back a little bit. We have Professor Mr. Kevin. Professor Mr. Kevin.
Yes, we do.
Yes, I'm happy
right,
to
bud.
Be here.
How are you?
I'm doing all right.
All right, you're 100%.
Right, although, give me just a second, and I'll tell you exactly how I'm doing.
Were you checking your spoos?
I got an error when I was checking my blood pressure.
Well, you must have some. You're talking.
I do. I have a pulse too. Apparently,
that's always a good sign.
Give this a try again. This is a treat for the audience to get this in real time, isn't it?
Yeah. By the way, you're going to have to take back some of the accusations you've made towards me about not being in the middle.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
And that ain't happening, so you tell me why.
Because
the
station we used to be on, I talked to them yesterday, they've gone to full progressive, and they said I'm way too much center and have too many right guests for being on a progressive station.
Well, when you talk progressive, I mean, look, there's liberal and there's progressive, and when they say they're progressive, what they're really saying is there's some sort of...
I don't even know what that means, to be honest with you. I know it's not me, but so I don't know what that if that's true, that leaves, I'm going to say, 65% of the world somewhere in the middle of a morass of some kind, if that's the two choices. But because I'm surely not that. So did the machine say you're alive or what?
It said VP normal.
There you go.
138 over 80. The 138 is a little high, but
that's pretty normal for a man of your advanced age. That's pretty good.
Lately, it's been a little lower than that. So, but you know, having it back is at one point I had some. You know, I had a significant crash. So. You know, it's okay now. It's okay.
But what does it say about the rest of you, normal?
Well, I've never been normal, so that one's a little bit harder to say.
That's pretty interesting. The news yesterday, I went on YouTube, and I was trying to find some sports stuff. Of course, I didn't know there were so many people that are either opining on this plane crash or opining on this Epstein thing. I mean, every guy who's ever been on a, you know, some kind of a TV show or any kind of a, who has a camera in his face, has got something one way or the other. It's astounding how many people have, you know, evidently the means to make a video and stick it on this YouTube and stuff. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, it seems... it seems to me that, you know, the big narrative on the whole thing is that, you know, all the Trump supporters are divided on this and disappointed, but CNN and Quinnipiac just released before and after polls, and Trump's actually up 2 points amongst the group that they say is so divided. So I don't know that this is such a big deal in terms of policy priorities, but it just seems to me that the path of least resistance would be take what you have, edit out victims' names, and just release the damn thing. We talked about this Wednesday, and we're probably giving it more time than it deserves in terms of where we are now and what we should expect. But, if there's a lot of intelligence agencies and so on involved in it, my attitude. I talked about this Wednesday. I said tough. Tough if you're getting exposed. If you're getting other stuff exposed along the way, too damn bad. This is not how I want our agencies to operate. I don't want us trying to compromise people, turn them into assets, turn them into make them cooperative people, just because we're compromising young women.
And they would say, "Wow, is that naive?" By the way, I'm with you on this one. But they would say,
"Okay, so tough shit. I'm naive."
Yeah, I'm not. You know, I'm with you on this. I'm saying.
Yeah, I do know that. I do know that.
It is a. Rightly or wrongly, if you look at the person's life, and again, you wonder how he could possibly be our savior in terms of moral whatever. But the fact is, he sort of hit a chord with a hell of a lot of people, which he's very good at, by the way, that somehow or another in the last, and I talk about it, maybe I'm not as forceful as I really feel, I talk about it economically in the last 25 years, I can't believe what's happened to the middle class and the lower class, and somewhere along the line, they know there's something wrong. They know they've been had. They just don't know how. And they look at the prices they pay and the stuff they have and the struggles they're having. They see what medical care costs, and if they're 50 years old, they look back and go, "God, when I was 25, this was a hell of a lot simpler. I mean, what were we doing here?" It's very difficult to put your finger on all the buttons, because there's a million buttons, and they all sort of lead to the same people who seem to be running the place, whoever the hell they are. So Trump comes in, and he's a breath of fresh air in the sense of what he said, maybe not what he did, but in what he said, and people believe the guy. Now, whether they should or they shouldn't, and that people debate that all day long, but the fact is, they believe the guy, and he said, "Look, I'm not going to let these people, these alligators in the swamp," because, by the way, I'm a New York guy. I've dealt with politicians before in some level. I see how kind of crooked they are. I'm going to clean some of this up. Now, of course, he reminds me a lot of Obama in the sense that he got co-opted the second he got there. Now who the co-opters are, that's what we constantly go back and forth on.
I think Obama was definitely co-opted before he got there.
Well, I'm saying to the world, he was a guy who was fresh. He was just there. He didn't have time to be co-opted, and it turns out he was, okay? And now, this guy sure didn't look like that he was...
You really have a hard time saying his name, don't you?
What do you mean? No, Trump is his name.
You hardly ever say Trump. You say this guy, you say...
Well, we know who the president is now.
Yeah, I know. You seem to have a really hard time saying his name.
I've
noticed this for quite a while.
Well, yeah, I do have a hard time putting him in the Oval Office, but I'm not talking about that today. What I'm saying is...
Just an observation.
He hit a chord on people that he was going to try and clean some of this up. And that there are people that are guilty of some really bad crap out there doing stuff. And yet, I don't know that anybody can do it. I've been very careful not to blame him on this one. Because I think I didn't blame Bush for 9/11, and yet then it happened, and now you got to deal with this mess. But that's what happens in that office for some reason. And now he's left with this thing, and I don't envy. I've said this 100 times. I don't envy this problem for him. But I think that in terms of prosecutorial stuff, I don't know how you prosecute these people. But President Trump, he's the guy who supposedly, this is your guy Bill O'Reilly, claims he's been researching this for 3 weeks, and the guy who's running this investigation is not Pam Bondi. It's a guy under him, a guy by the name of Todd Blanche. Now, Todd Blanche was a prosecutor in New York. Then he becomes Trump's personal attorney. And now he's doing this. Jesus Christ, that's a walking conflict of some kind. Now, I'm not saying he can't do a good job. Now, the question is, I don't think he can prosecute any of these people, Kevin. If you know their phone numbers, you know they were there. If you don't have films on them, I don't know how you prosecute it. Plus, is it beyond, does messing with a minor, is that like murder? Is there no statute on that? Or is a statute? I don't even know that. I mean, where's Lil Wayne Needham? You're not going to try and put all these people in there. And you can't just take rumors and lob them out there and ruin people's lives. Yet, you know, an awful lot of bad crap went on in three places, in Florida, in Manhattan, and down there. You can't just let it go either. I tell you what, Kevin, I'm glad it's him and not me. Let's put it that way. Because I think if we put everything in the show together and say, what should we do? I think we'd have a problem coming up with a conclusion. Wouldn't you?
Yeah, if you open the files, especially if you're saying, okay, case closed, we're not investigating anymore, then aren't those files subject to public disclosure?
Well, they can come out and have everything redacted to the last word.
I know.
I mean, it doesn't surprise me. I, as you know, I do not want boys playing with girls in competitive sports, unless it's softball and there's two to four girls on a team and everybody knows that's what's going on.
If it's a co-rec league and it's understood, yeah, of course.
But I
and by the way, there are conventions for that. You know, we didn't do wipeout slides at second base if it was a girl covering.
Yeah, and I hate it when they ran into me.
No kid.
One girl runs into our first baseman, and it was her fault. She says to the guy, "That's more than I've got in a month." The guy's like, "Really?" All of a sudden, his mind was off the game, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, I get
you. But, you know, we're talking about a group of people that made that an election thing. I would never vote for somebody because they ran on a ticket of... I just think it's wrong to have, you know, competitive stuff. So, okay, somebody breaks a girl's nose, and, you know, who knows? I mean, it got worse and worse as time went on, but it was a big election thing. Now, tonight...
Well, you saw the Olympic boxing and some of the swimming and a lot of the track, especially high school level track.
I'm with you on this. What I'm saying is the same group that feels that is a serious election item, you know, top three item, is the same group that's going to say, wait a minute, we're not letting old guys go or Arab guys go or whoever the hell they are that running around boffing 14-year-olds that somebody's setting up for them. It doesn't surprise me that the same group, including me, by the way, is not really pissed off about that. I mean, is it? Are you? I mean...
Yeah, it shouldn't be. Like I said, you know, before, we're probably giving it more time than it deserves just because... There's two aspects to it, and you know we 100% agree, and I think most people agree. Would be right on this, where we're saying, you know, the people who were involved should be exposed, but by the same token, the process here that's involved, you know, like you said, you don't want to be in that position. I don't know, what's going to happen with it. There are things that I just can't I can't control it, I guess is the best way to say it. I don't have any influence over it, so I'm more in the sit back and watch mode when it comes to what's ultimately going to happen with this.
Well, I always try and put, you know, what happens in your, everybody does this, you filter the news based on your own kind of opinion sort of thing, and you know, I own, everybody knows, my brother and I own a brokerage firm, an investment advisory firm, and I am, well, my brother more than me, because he has to deal with them all the time, is exceptionally aware of the, I would say, the capabilities / intrusiveness / whatever of the regulatory authorities. We had, in our place, we had, they make you do your own audit, right, which is, you know, $12,000-$15,000. Then NFA came in and audited us, every single nickel, back and forth. Then the FINRA came in the week after NFA was here. I mean, we pass all these audits, we always do, but it's a royal pain. Now, you can't tell me that the same people can't figure out where Epstein got all this money. It's the same people that are up.
That's what I mean, but you know, they should release the files, because we at least that much has got to be on file.
No, it isn't. Why would no? You don't think that they've sigged one of these firms on this guy to find out where every nickel came from? I think they've stayed away there like the plague.
Okay.
I mean, what do you? The first thing you and I would do is say, before we start naming people, let's follow the money. How does this guy? But he paid $21 million for the island, right? The house in Manhattan was one of the biggest houses in Manhattan. I have no idea what the place in Palm Beach was like. But it had to be pretty damn nice. I mean, how do you get that kind of dough, Kevin? You and I can't write a check for that, can we?
Well, we'd have to combine.
Yeah, we'd have to get Carl and Lua. I don't know. You think Flanagan would help? I don't know. He doesn't want to leave his house, let alone get onto some island.
Well, you get a house like that, you don't have to leave it.
You know, I'm not big on these islands. Plus, of course, it's a U.S. island, not a British. Do you even know where these places are? I mean, I went to Bahamas once. I couldn't wait to get out of there. I mean, where's the Caicoses and these guys and those guys? I mean, you put them all on a map. I couldn't even name you. I'd probably tell you which one Cuba is. That's about it.
Now, which one did you dislike about? What did you dislike about the Bahamas?
We were giving seminars, and so Audrey says, you know, they have this conch. You'll love this conch. So I had a conch omelet, I had a conch sandwich, I was done with conch. Two meals was... The thing I hated the most, so many mosquitoes, and I'm giving lectures, and there were mosquitoes in the lecture hall, and they're biting my feet while I'm trying to talk. So there, as a piece of personal information.
That would be a good reason to dislike.
I just had no, you know, they had a casino there, went to the casino, it was kind of the crummy old casino, and... We left. I couldn't wait to get out of there. Just, I don't know.
Well, yeah, and casinos don't do much for me. So you know that would be a problem. How were the beaches?
We didn't do any of that. What we did was lecture and stuff.
Hangout guy.
We did go down to the Atlantis when it was new. That place is pretty neat. But now I think it's kind of come into disrepair. I don't know if it needs a big remodel. But those, you know, you wear those places out fast. But I did remember Kevin walking along the dock there. You should have seen some of these boats. Plus, all these people from like Latin America, they're walking along. You know, and we were giving seminars, so we were fairly dressed up. These guys are walking along with pairs of shoes and watches that were worth three times my whole wardrobe. I mean, the amount of money in these boats, you're walking along the dock, and, you know, a pretty tall guy. The bow of the boat is about 8 feet over my head. You know, you could rent one of those things and stay in one of these yachts if you wanted for the week for like $10,000. With a staff cooking for you, everything. Now the trick is, if you wanted to go for a ride, you had to fill it up. That might have been $20,000. I mean, because these things had, you know, enormous tanks. I mean, we're talking about boats that are 125 feet long, 150. I mean, it's unbelievable the wealth in some of these places. I mean, you look at it and you go, man, I don't see anything like that in Chicago. You know, there's some pretty rich people here, I think, but good Lord. I mean, does everybody just escape places and go to these places or what? It's just not us.
So you really couldn't relate to the general clientele, to the vacation clientele.
No, that's a fairly sound way of saying it. Hey, I got a question for you. Since we haven't done any jacks in a while, I was looking at this baseball draft, and all I seem to have here is questions. Every time I do something these days, all I do is get questions on this stuff. How does the White Sox end up with somehow? Explain to me this no tanking rule. For those that don't know, the Sox had the worst season in the history of baseball last year, and they couldn't participate in the lottery because they don't want people being crummy because they tank, right? So the White Sox end up with the 10th pick in the first round, but allegedly the first pick in the second round, which is bizarre. Do you think they tanked? I didn't. I think they were just horrible. They didn't have any players.
Well, maybe that's because they tanked the year before. I don't know. They were, and I guess it doesn't matter. You know, it's to prevent tanking. It's to prevent them from, you know, just getting rid of all their players and losing on purpose. They want, you know, they want teams to compete, and it's based on, you know, on what your record is over consecutive years, not necessarily what your intent was. They're not trying to read intent into it. So they're just saying, look, you had your high pick last year. You're not getting the same as high a pick this year. I guess you get to suck again this year, and they should be back near the top of the draft.
Well, they snagged the first round pick of the Mets, the Yankees, and the Dodgers for must be for paying too much money or something. Is that the story?
Yeah. So there's the luxury tax. It's kind of convoluted in baseball, but yeah. There's luxury tax, so it's how much you spend on payroll. You know, you would ask me about how Baltimore, who had a lot of wins last year, got in there, wormed their way in there, and that had to do with the amount of their payroll, and the market that they're in. There's the small markets, big markets. There's a whole bunch of factors that go into it. That keeps anybody from any normal person from understanding it, but it is all built around trying to engineer competitive balance. But the thing you can't engineer is incompetent management, which a lot of these teams have.
Well, if you look at, you might say, okay, the Sox get the first round pick in first pick in the second round, which to most people would be the 31st pick, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not so, Buffalo Breath. Somehow or another, there's three or four different, and I'll get them here in a second, but there's three or four different. The Sox drafted 10th in the first round. Let me see if I can find where the Orioles are. Because they won 90 some games last year, didn't they?
Yeah.
So they picked 19th, all right, in the first round. Now, now you get to this middle part here. Prospect promotion incentive pick. Whatever in God's name that is, which is now the 28th pick because the three teams lost their first-round pick, so you only had 27 picks. So the Royals picked some guy. Then you got compensation picks. The Diamondbacks, two Orioles, the Brewers. Then you had competitive balance round A, which gives Red Sox, Tigers, Mariners, Twins, and then the Orioles again. Then there's the continued first-round guys that should have been in the first round. The Mets, Yankees, and Dodgers are now 38th, 39th, and 40th. So now the Orioles, we now have four picks before the Sox, who won like 40 games, get their second-round pick. And the second-round pick is actually the first pick is actually the 41st pick, which I mean, anybody looks at this and says, wait a minute, we're giving a team that won 90-plus games five picks in the first 40, and we're given a team that was absolutely horse bleep one pick in the first 40. If you look at that, the first thing out of your mind is, are you sure you guys are doing this right? I would think.
I think whatever they do, it's not going to matter that much. I mean, it does. Accumulating draft picks, as we saw with the 2016 Cubs, the years leading up to that, they were accumulating draft picks, and that can work out. That can work out really well. I mean, you see this with the White Sox right now. They have some very interesting guys at the major league level who would typically be at the minor league level because they don't have anybody. They don't have any major leaguers, so they don't suck as bad as last year, and they're a little more intriguing than last year. Because some of these guys show talent, but it accumulating the picks is important. Picking well is more important, and really all they're saying is if you lose free agents, there's places where you're supposed to be able to, you have to make them an offer at some point, and then if you still lose them, then you get compensation. But if you didn't make them an offer, then you don't get compensation. And there's a lot of if-then built into this. And this is where team management makes especially for a team that's trying to rebuild, it either earns its money or doesn't, is by understanding how all of this stuff works and making it work for them.
Well, this this kid, the Sox just brought up to play. Shortstop, and he was a number one pick out of high school in Indiana.
Yeah,
in 2020. And looks to me like the kid's got nothing but talent. And but that, I think, I was reading some article, Kevin, and he's a good kid, supposedly. That 3 years right out of high school, in the rookie league, and then the next A league, and then during the winter, I don't know if you're doing anything. And I think that's a real hard slog. He almost quit. That's a tough slide.
And he almost failed too. You know, they expected him to be the starting shortstop for on opening day. Wound up having to send him to the minors, and then he was playing very, very poorly in the minors as well. So they just gave him time out, sent him to Arizona to their training facility, and did a lot of one-on-one work for him before they put him back into the minor league team and then ultimately brought him up to the major league team. So, this is the Billy Bean, the Moneyball philosophy, where he didn't want to draft anybody out of high school. He wanted to spend his high draft picks on college players, because at age 21, he had a much better idea of who they were than he would have had at 17 or 18. And that the risk was just too high on those guys, because you're so talented. Those guys are so gifted that against high school competition, they can get they can dominate and have flaws in their game.
I'll read you this thing about this number 8th pick from the Blue Jays. We'll go to break. A guy named JoJo Parker, shortstop from Purvis High School in MS is Mississippi, right? MN is Maine.
Yeah.
All right, Mississippi. Yeah. Says Parker can really swing it from the left side, earning plus hit tool projections, whatever that means, with a chance for average or better power to follow. He's also likely to remain somewhere on the dirt, albeit probably not at shortstop. That combination has enabled him to climb boards over the spring and summer with the scouts that I spoke of, predicting he'll go within the first dozen picks, which he went number 8. Parker's twin brother, Jacob, an outfielder, is also in this class. Both are committed to Mississippi State. Now, after break, explain to me what that happens. Did they lose him? We'll dash off. SP Feeders up 1, NASA Feeders up 11. We'll be right back. Stacks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now. Hello
and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tamal, Ricky on the board. SP Features up 2, Nancy Features up 12. We had a big day yesterday. We have one of the things we have to be concerned about, and we'll see what they're doing this morning here, is these interest rates, is the 30-year went through 5 yesterday and stayed there. Just a little over, but stayed there. Over in Europe, we have I have so much stuff here, Ricky, with all this baseball and everything else. Why don't you do a traffic weather? Well, here we go. European shares tick higher as earnings hold the spotlight. We have a couple of earnings coming out today. Essentially, was Netflix is down $21. Straddle was 80, so that's well within the movement of the market thought. So it's kind of a surprise. It's only moved that much. Over in the DAX down 37.2%, FTSE down 39 cents. Call that flat. Kick around up 3. Call that flat. So not much going over there. Even though they claim they're ticking higher, it's not much of a higher. Nikkei down 82.2%. Hang Seng up 326, 1.3. It's a big move there. Shanghai up 17.5%. The Australian stocks hit a record high. We have to get Rita Coolidge back in here one of these days. It's the bond girl. It's an all-time high. Bonds actually down 3 basis points on the 10-year, 4.43. So that's having more trouble breaking through to 4.5 than the 30 does at 5, which is kind of surprising. The Bund up one basis point, 2.69. Japan down 2 basis points, 1.53. Oil up 60 cents, 68.14. Rent up 49 cents, 70.01. Natural gas up 1, 355.8. Did hear last night, Kevin and Ricky, from one of our futures sources, that for some reason heating oil is racing up here, even though oil is not. And I don't quite know what that's mean. Is it? A guy asked me last night, does that mean there's a war? I said, boy, I don't know. I'm not so sure I'd make that jump, but evidently heating oil has been very volatile, even though oil has been doing nothing. The full crude. Gold up $14, $33.59. Silver up 38 cents, 38.68. Copper up 5 cents, 5.56. So copper has stayed up there. It's kept the 60 cent run from the tariff announcement on copper. So it's still there. The euro is 116.4. British pound, none of these things are moved that much. 134.5. Crypto, down 471, but still kind of rarefied air here at 118.999. Ricky, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Morning, Chief. It's currently 6:34 a.m. here in beautiful Chicago. We're looking at 64 degrees right now with a high of 76. Nice with sunshine and a few clouds. Tonight will be humid with increasing amounts of clouds. Thunderstorm in spots toward dawn with a low of 70 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 88 degrees right now with a high of 107. Partly sunny and very, very warm. A thunderstorm in spots this afternoon. Tonight, another thunderstorm warning. Otherwise, it will be mainly clear with a low of 86 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, Iman Kennedy from Monroe, 60 minutes. We're looking at 30 minutes. Iman Edens from Lane Cook. Iman Eisenhower from Wolf, 19 minutes. We're looking at 13 minutes. Iman Dan Ryan from 95th. And lastly, Iman Stevenson from turning 4th to the Dan Ryan. 23 minutes. Lastly, MLB real quick. Red Sox today at Cubs, 1:20 p.m. White Sox at Pirates, 5:40 p.m. And lastly, Cardinals at Diamondbacks, 8:40 p.m. Back over to you guys.
So what does that mean, Kevin? If somebody gets drafted and then they're already committed, now, do they lose that pick or what?
Well, no. The committed part is they can choose not to go to college. So. You've got all these players, and many of them, most of the high draft picks have chosen a college. So they've gone through that recruiting process, and basically what they've told the college is, depending on where I get drafted, if I don't like my draft position, I'll come to college. There are probably some people who also say, well, I value getting the free education, still playing baseball. But what happens is, if those guys do go to college, so they'll do everything they can to get them signed. Because if they go to college, yeah, they've lost the pick. That pick is they can't touch them for 3 years, and then at the end of 3 years, they re-enter the draft.
Okay, but then
so they've all been having conversations about what it's going to take to sign before they're ever getting drafted. And signability will absolutely become part of the decision about when you draft a guy. If you think he's asking for the sun, the moon, and the stars, and you're not willing to pay that, and he has the option to go back to college, you're not going to draft the guy, even if he's the best player available.
It's one of the issues who's the guy that became the general manager of the Cubs, and they won the World Series, and everybody was talking about how spectacular he was. Guy from Boston. Not that he wasn't, but
yeah, Theo Epstein.
The guy before him, just how organizations can screw over people. What Kevin is talking about, the guy before him was a guy named Jim Henry. A pretty terrific guy, and he had huge success with the Twins at building this minor league system. So the Cubs decide they're gonna build by way of the minor leagues, and they bring him down here. But they didn't. They refused to up his budget or something, Kevin. So he was really.
I think it was his last year when they finally said, "Yeah, go ahead, sign everybody."
Because that's what he would do. He'd draft these people, and then he'd lose them to college because they didn't give the budget to essentially buy them away from college. Where do you think the name, image, and likeness is in regards to baseball in college? Are they ready to outbid for a minor league contract or what? Probably not.
I don't think they're going to outbid a very high round draft picks, a high picks, the team that drafted them. I don't think they're going to outbid the MLB team. I will say, there's probably more money available at some schools that where baseball is more watched and has more of a hardcore fan following. I'm talking about Texas, LSU, Florida State, places like that. North Carolina, North Carolina State has a really good program. So a lot of those, they get a whole lot of people to come out for baseball. The northern schools, that's a little bit different. You don't even have decent weather for people to go to a ball game. Until mid-March at the earliest, and even then you get a lot of bad weather games and you don't get much attendance. They play, they go on the road. They basically spend their first 20 or 20-25 games on the road, playing in tournaments, non-conference opponents in the South and so on. So it's a little bit different. You get some really good northern teams and northern programs, but by and large, You know, it's really a southern phenomenon, and that limits the number of schools that are out there bidding for the talent.
Yeah, I would think you're probably right about that. The northernmost one that's kind of good all the time is Vanderbilt, but they're not exactly north.
And that's not what I would consider north.
It's not South Bend.
And but South Bend is definitely what you would consider north. So when you're looking at, you know, the Big Ten schools and so on, you get some of them, and they'll make the College World Series, and they'll make a splash, and have really good seasons. But it is really hard to sustain it. What you can do to be competitive all the time is just make sure you get a few pitchers. I mean, that, you know, you really the way it works is once the conference season starts, you're pretty much playing Friday, Saturday, Sunday conference games, whether on the road or whether at home. And then during the week is when, you know, your freshman pitchers are going to pitch, because they're always going to get a game in against somebody local. So, you know, Notre Dame, because I live here and I take notice of who they're playing, they might play Oakland University. They might play, they might get a game against a Michigan or Michigan State. But by and large, you know, they'll play Valparaiso, they'll play a game against Butler, they'll get those kind of games in during the week. That's where they get their young guys some experience, but they really hold back, and they, you know, if they have three good starting pitchers, those three good starting pitchers are pitching on the weekend.
I think like the first eight or nine picks, the eighth wasn't, but the first few picks are all pitchers.
Pitchers and shortstops, yep.
Well, the first kid was a shortstop from Fort Cobb Braxton High School. Wow. Surefire, a guy named Eli Willits out of some high school. And then the Angels, UC Santa Barbara, they had a good team, right? Were they in the World Series?
Yeah, they Southern California colleges, there's a lot of good ones. And there's good ones that'll, you know, there's consistently good programs. It's a little like college hockey, where in college hockey you have all your big name schools that you recognize. And then you know, in college hockey, you get your Mankato States and, you know, Massachusetts Lowell and places like that that have really good programs. There are some of those out there. Coastal Carolina is one that pops into my mind, that consistently have good, really good baseball. And so, you know, you can pull it off because there's a limited number of scholarships. So you can pull it off. But what you really need, if you're going to compete, is you just have to make sure you have enough pitchers to so that you get in these short series and you feel like you can at least win two out of three with the pitching you have.
This guy who went number three is a guy we all, if you watch the College World Series, he was a serious pitcher there from LSU. This guy, Cade Anderson.
Mm-hmm.
And interesting on this, Kevin, is you and I watch, you know, a lot of Major League Baseball, and you get somebody coming 90, 95 pitches now with you, they can't wait to yank the guy. Even, you know, some guys that go a little further that aren't all out every pitch, like the guy in the Cubs, Shota, he's not throwing 98, so he could probably hang in there more pitches, but some guys can't. And so this guy, I seem to remember, which brings me back to one of the greatest trivia questions ever, I think this kid was what? He was 125, 130 in that last game of the World Series? Now, do you want to do an arm?
They're a little more abusive. They're protective. And the Cubs are looking at that with Cade Horton right now. He's important to their rotation, and yet they're sitting there saying, "I don't know what to do about this guy because he's halfway through the season and he's already thrown more pitches than he's ever thrown in his career."
Well, which would you be more?
A lot of that was due to injuries, past injuries that he had. But nevertheless, they're very protective of the asset once they sink enough millions or hundreds of thousands of dollars into him.
Wasn't the old joke, because it turned out to not be a joke. But the old joke was, how many pitches did Kerry Wood pitch on the day he got drafted? Because they used to have these drafts earlier in the year, right? Where high school season was still going on. And he threw like 140 pitches that day. He threw a seven-inning game, and they brought him in relief in the second game.
Yeah, high school coaches are notorious for doing it. And then you get a lot of these guys that are playing, they might be playing high school summer ball. They'll also play you know, I don't know how much they still do American Legion, but American Legion was always a factor, and some travel teams, and there's no coordination among the coaches, so they can be pretty damned abusive.
What's the Cape Cod League? That's college, right? That's the Wood Bat League?
Yeah, that's a college summer league, yeah.
Well, what do you... I think it would depend on the kind of pitcher you are, but what do you think is worse? 120 pitches in a day, or to me, if it was your first season, the reason I'm talking about this, you listen to Mark Burley talk the other day when he came back for the Sox thing for the World Series people, and he was saying that one of the hardest parts about it was I had 3 days off between starts and I was bored stiff. Imagine if he had 4 days off. I'm kind of stunned that these relief pitchers pitch all the time, and a starter goes 60 pitches and he needs 4 days off. Why the hell can't, if you're going to only pitch 60 pitches, why do you need 4 days off? Why can't you go with three? Like they used to.
Well, if you had 60 pitches, you didn't pitch well. So if you didn't get up in the, you know, in the 90 pushing 100, you probably didn't pitch well unless you're Greg Maddux. And so they want to give you the time off.
Well, that's where my point is.
Come back.
I mean, 4 days rest on anything is kind of a long time when you're 25 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how you can't. I mean, what Fergie Jenkins used to go every 4 days, and he used to pitch batting practice between the two of them, keep his arm loose, right? But I've had
Jeff Passan's book, The Arm, for forever, about pitchers' arms and managing this, and I've had it, and I've never gotten the chance to start into it, and I really should, because I think it talks a lot about that. And you look at the draft. You know, my first question is when I see that the Cubs, for instance, drafted a pitcher. And then I say, has he had his Tommy John surgery yet, or do we have that to look forward to as part of the development process?
Well, I've mentioned this before, but
it seems like it's inevitable now.
I wonder, somebody somewhere always keeps track of everything, Kevin, but the Tribune, I just started the trading floor, so it must have been in the 80s at some point. The Tribune's like once a month would give the back page of the sports section to a some kind of a sports doctor. And he would take the whole page and talk about sprinting, swimming, or pitching. And he was saying that the pitching, he goes, I can tell by looking at a guy if he's gonna pitch for many years, I can tell you what muscle he's gonna wreck. He said the only way that you can literally pitch, you know, all day, which is too, you know, an exaggeration. He said if you look at somebody when they go through their motion, the line between their index finger through their elbow, through their shoulder blades, down the other arm, which should also be extended. If it's a perfectly straight line, they're putting virtually no stress on their arm. If they're under it, I think he said if they're under it, you're gonna have a shoulder problem, and if you're over it, you're gonna have an elbow problem. If you pitch a real lot and you pitch real hard. Which they're doing now. They pitch as fast as they can every pitch. And he ended up, he predicted Oral Hershiser was going to have shoulder surgery because they used the word pronate. I don't know if he over-pronated or under-pronated, whatever he did, but he showed pictures of him. He said he's going to need shoulder surgery, and somebody else at the same time said he's going to need elbow surgery. The next year, Oral Hershiser had shoulder surgery, and the other guy had, and he said that when he had Tom Seaver, Roger Clemens, Greg Maddux, he didn't go back as far as Fergie. So the line is perfectly straight. They're never going to have an arm problem. And they didn't. He just said it's mechanical. I mean, Kerry Wood, in the windup, what he would do, also when you head toward home plate, your left foot, if you're righty, is supposed to be pointing directly toward home plate. So you're not coming across your body at all. If you notice, Kerry Wood in his early years, it's why he never pitched out of a windup after his surgery. His left foot would not come all the way to the plate. He would have a 20-degree angle essentially toward the third base dugout, which caused him to come across his body with his arm. And then he found out after his surgery he didn't do that in a stretch. Then he went into relief pitching and everything else. He never pitched out of the windup again because they caught that piece after the surgery. Now, whether
I also, you know, along the same lines, I remember reading an article. I don't know if I was college age or what, but they were talking about the number of innings pitched before age 25. The premise of that particular article being that you really kind of become physically mature around 25. Well, otherwise you're up until then you're a growing boy. So they were looking at the number of innings, and I remember them using the example of Doc Gooden, that he had thrown so many innings when he was very young, and the prediction there was that he would be on a fast track to 150 wins, but would never reach 200, which is about how it worked out, if I remember correctly, for him. But just because, you know, his arm would start to die. Now, there was probably a cocaine aspect to that as well, that might have that would have impacted his career. So I don't know that that's a perfectly fine analysis of that situation. I remember another part of the article was talking about Nolan Ryan. Now, there was a whole generation of Mets pitchers. Seaver and Ryan and John Matlack and all those who
Jerry Koosman was one of those guys too, right?
Jerry Koosman was another one who all, even though they had different calibers of arms, you know, and different abilities to throw hard or not, that what they all had was perfect mechanics that they were taught. You know, the idea that, you know, the leg that they used to push off the rubber, they had so much back into it and so much reach that the knee was always dirty, like by the end of the first inning. So, you know, that was part of the equation too. But they mentioned Ryan specifically because they said Ryan did not throw a lot of innings when he was young. He threw more innings later in his career, but when he was very young, he hadn't thrown a lot, and that he would last a long time, which he kind of did.
Well, I mean, I remember my uncle, who was really into baseball, and, you know, I kind of lost track of him. My mother got remarried, long story there, but I was pitching in Little League, and he goes, you know, you throw the ball hard enough, you don't let anybody talk you into throwing a curveball till you're 16. Your arm's not ready for it. And, you know, and it turns out I pretty much stopped pitching, started moving to one of the other sports, is that still a thing? Don't be throwing a curveball in Little League, for God's sake.
Well, it probably should be is the best way that I can put it, because that's a different stress on your arm that you don't need at such a young age. However, I know that they're throwing curveballs. Heck, I remember some of the better pitchers in Little League, Pony League, that era, throwing curveballs.
So, well, you can if you. I remember you could monkey with the grip, and now some of these guys throw a breaking ball, but it's not a curveball; it's just a different grip.
Right. It's you know, how many seams on the fastball am I holding? Is it a sinker? Is it a sinking fastball? Is it a tailing fastball? All of that kind of stuff. Yep.
Hey, Kevin, I want to get I'll use the term layman. When I say layman, you're not trading all day like me. Layman's view of, you know, we've touched on it, and I'll talk more about it with Carl, but. When you look at stuff, valuations, and of course, you know, I met some people last night, and not a one of them is selling. And how can you when the market basically goes up every day? It's really, I mean, I don't even tell people, you know, they're my clients. I mean, unless, you know, I might say we need to protect because of your station in life and blah blah blah, and these stocks have had a big run. I know you like them, but how do you, when you get to a situation, and it's really kind of all the same thing, and I just want your opinion on whether I'm going to create. To me, I've never seen anything quite like somebody spending $10 billion for a basketball team, and other people can't get their car fixed. I mean, I've never seen anything quite like this sort of spread. And I look at the market, you know, I've been around a while, and none of this stuff is predictive or anything. But I thought when the 2000 fiasco happened for the dot-bomb companies, well, they weren't. I mean, drama real companies, Cisco, Oracle, those kinds of places, where they lost basically 80% of their value. I remember being at a seminar that Dr. J scheduled, and then he didn't go and asked me to cover for him in Brooklyn, of all places. One time I've ever been to Brooklyn, and this is before it was nice, and the whole room had owned Cisco at like 60, 65 bucks. It was one of the Magnificent Five at the time, and the stock was trading $6.50 or $7. And one guy's accusing me as a trader of wrecking his life because I sold his Cisco down. And I said, first of all, I don't trade Cisco. Secondly, traders don't set prices. The public sets prices. All the traders do is make a two-sided market, which is true, by the way. And so anyway, I said, by the way, you're giving me a hard time. I'm going to ask you a question. What do you think the revenue per share is of Cisco? And he goes, what do you mean? I said, why did you think that Cisco was a buy or a assured investment at 66? I did the calculation because I knew you guys were going to ask me this stuff, and I trade the OEX. I don't know Cisco from beans, which I didn't. I traded the OEX all day. And I said, the thing has $6 a share revenue. It's trading 11 times revenue. I mean, did you even look at that? The guy looked at me like I had four heads. Why would I look at that? The stock was going up. Everybody liked it. I'm like, duh. Well, I'm looking today, Kevin, and I'm doing one a day because I don't want to sound like I'm doggy downer on the show or anything, but NVIDIA is trading 174. Their revenue is $6 per share. Netflix is, which is, what is that? 20-something times 20. It's like 40 times revenue. Netflix, 14, 15 times. We're not talking earnings. We're talking revenue. Oracle's revenue per share is way lower now than it was in 2020, and they were one of the ones that crashed. I mean, I see them going up. I see the stuff with the AI. I see concentration. Maybe NVIDIA is the last man standing, and it's going to double revenue for the next 5 years. I don't know anything. I don't know enough to say that can't happen. When I start looking at 5 and 6 and 7 and 10 stocks of that size, all in that same rarefied 20, 30, 50% higher than they were in 2000, I just wonder, are we talking about two different worlds here? What are we doing? I mean, other than the fact, I know momentum traders, you buy stuff because it's going up. I get that. And you sell stuff because it's going down. That's what the retail public does. But at some point, don't you think somebody takes a look? I mean, even though the world's greatest companies, I happen to think the Lakers are a great franchise. $2 billion, maybe 10. I mean, what is everybody seeing but me? That the future's so bright, we got to wear shades here, or what?
Well, so I don't know what I'm still kind of unsure of what your question is. What are you asking me about? Sort of the everyman point of view.
Well, I mean, when people right now, everyman, the people we know, is in the market mostly because of 401k stuff. Mm-hmm. And you're going to be in some kind of index fund. First of all, does the regular person even know that the $500 they put in last week, 250 of it's going into five stocks, and what the valuation now is of those five stocks? Do they care? Do they know it's going up?
I think a lot of people do. I don't think everyone does. So, there's a lot of people that just say, well, yeah, put it in that fund and there you go. But some of the people who, when they give you your investment options, they give you a pretty good idea of what's going to be in there. So they're not bad at that, but a lot of people don't pay attention to that. They're just looking at the yield and saying, yeah, do that. But otherwise, I don't think, most people just don't follow it that closely. You follow it closely because that's what you do for a living. Most people don't.
Well, what do you think would have to happen for, say, you had a friend, Joe, to roll over on a Monday morning and say, Ethel, where these Qs are at all times high, I don't like where these stocks are priced, I'm going to pull them out of that 401k and put them in a money market fund. I don't see that ever happening, Kevin. So, I mean, if the market does go flying the other way some way, I wish it wouldn't take everybody with them, but I don't see how it won't. I don't think.
Well, and it does that because, excuse me, I'm almost turning into Lou from yesterday. Let me cough for a sec.
So you need a cough button like we have here in the office.
I I just hit the mute before I coughed.
I'm saying we actually have a cough button. It has a picture of a guy coughing on it.
Yeah, it does. I remember the studio. So, okay. But, yeah, we people don't manage it. They don't have time to manage stuff. It parks and it doesn't get another thought until, of course, the day comes where we have the big event. Everything crashes and we wipe out everybody's 401k.
Which I don't expect. I guess what I'm saying, Kevin, is I don't expect everybody to watch it like me. But is anybody having any sort of thoughts that, man, this stuff is kind of high? I mean, let me pull back some. None of my clients are. I mean,
when you throw in things like the Lakers, yeah, nobody. That's just like this other world, and it doesn't relate to me. So that's the attitude you get for those kinds of things. But the average stocks, everybody just knows Nvidia's in the news every day. They're really high.
Yeah, I mean,
must be good.
But you know, the weird part of it is we have a lot of people. You know, we have a lot of clients, and we've had people. My brother Dan has a bunch that really didn't want to be in any of these stocks. And one thing you can do is instead of getting in your QQQs or the spiders or whatever, I used to call them baby spiders, but there used to be nine of them that added up to the big spider. Spider being the S&P 500. So the XLE is the oil piece, and the XLF is the banking piece. But then that's split in half, though, Kevin. Now it's like the the companies in the fixed income business versus the actual banks. So there's one more little spider than there used to be. But the XLV is the healthcare piece. And you would think, I mean, Dan's got a lot of people that said, no, I want to be in the XLV, and some of them are in the XLE, which is the oil piece. And there's another one for, there's eight of them. I can't name all eight, but and they're dragging. They're not doing anywhere near. Like, and if you're not in these top five or seven, you're kind of sucking hind tit. You're up, okay. I mean, it's not like you're losing, but you're not. When somebody says, "Yeah, man, the market's up 20%," you go, "Oh, not my market." I have everybody I think knows that I don't know if we specialize in it necessarily, but we're one of the few firms that will actually try and manage a concentrated position for somebody. Most firms want no part of that. I mean, if you end up having, $1.5 million, it all happens to be UPS or Exxon or something. All people want is the cash and put you in big cap Bob and mid cap Mike stuff. Well, we'll actually manage that position with options to try and, hopefully protect you. Hopefully, maybe protect you for free if there's some we can sell some calls in or something. But they're very difficult things to do, and not many people that don't have my experience are willing to do this, right? Kevin, I got probably five or six of those stocks. Every one of them is down. Every one of them. It's getting buried. I mean, you wouldn't believe, but we just had a couple of clients, and unfortunately, she died. We had UPS. For God's sake. We got UPS is trading $99. When we got it, it was $208. I mean, Accenture on its ass. I mean, it's incredible how many stocks of companies that are in good industries you would think would be doing okay that are just going the absolute opposite direction of these five or seven stocks that keep going up every day. I mean, it's actually more than that, but I'm saying it is. I don't know if I've seen a more difficult time like for the market. I mean, Nike used to be 120, it's 73. I mean, you can very easily have a stock here and you wonder, what's everybody cheering about? That's kind of weird.
But you also, got to mute again. But you also, there's a lot of ways to look at it. We're kind of talking on a very macro level. But I also recall, when Dan Janinas used to come on, he was, his approach was really all about evaluating management teams and directions of companies, and it wasn't necessarily the big time companies. And, I would think if you really want to be a successful investor, it isn't really about the Magnificent Seven. It's really about finding places where you know, you have confidence that a company is well run, that it's going to do well, and it's just going to continue to thrive, even if it's not putting out the biggest returns on going, that it's giving you just consistent money-making opportunities. And to me, you know, that's a much more prudent approach than what you see a lot of done. And that includes, you know, sticking your money into funds.
Well, yeah, I mean, funds are... So what do you got going this weekend? Something good?
Hey, you know what? I might cut the grass. I might actually feel good enough to cut the grass this weekend.
Well, good for you. The you guys, you on a kayak at all? We still got that thing?
You know, I do, and I haven't been out because, as you know, I've been ill all summer, and that, you know, and this week has been really good for me physically, and yeah, I may just get out and paddle around the lake a few times.
Hey, good for you. Good for you. I'm going to try and walk the dogs till they're tired, which the one who's 18 or pushing 19, it doesn't take long to get her tired. Now, the poodle, you could walk from here to Mars, and she wouldn't be tired. So yeah, I have two different dogs to walk. One, you got to watch how far she goes. The other one's dragging my ass, so... So always anyway, talk at you, bud. SP Futures up 3, NASDAQ Futures up 575. Do we have Professor Carl?
Oh, you do.
How you do, bud?
Hi, you know, I listened to the entire first hour of the show because, you know, I was up a reasonable time. My crazy cat decided what he usually likes to do is show up and start purring at me at 6 in the morning and, like, pawing at my hand. Here, scratch me. Scratch me. I really want you to pet me. I want you to pet me. Go away, cat. Come back in another hour, right?
Yeah. They're not gonna
do that. Well, I mean, I could get up, throw him out, close the door, and then, you know, then he sits there, meow, meow. So I'm like, all right, whatever. I'll get up. I got my espresso machine. It turns itself on at 5, and so the coffee's hot. We're good. But, you know, you got a bunch of really interesting things going on here, and I got dragged more or less into the political aspect of things with regards to the blog, and, you know, in my
commentary. How can you not, Carl?
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, when I first started publishing the Market Ticker. What drove it, and I know we've talked about this before, but for those people that, you know, that haven't followed it all the way along.
By the way, Carl does a great job on that thing.
What drove that was, I'm trading, I'm enjoying life, I'm raising a daughter, I've got a boat, you know, I go out and I deep sea fish or dive or whatever have you, and I wake up one morning and all of a sudden the entire Asian market has blown up for no apparent reason.
Okay. Operating word there being apparent to you.
Well, I mean, you know, I get up, I turn on my trading console, and there is a big red vertical line, right? And I'm like, what in the blankety blank is going on here, right? I mean, I'm like, did somebody just start World War III? Because, I mean, that's the kind of thing that you would think would, you know, would do something like that, right? And, you know, I didn't see any mushroom clouds out my back window. And I'm like, okay. So I go digging around. And, you know, shortly after that, you know, all the stuff with Washington Mutual and the, you know, the essentially kiting earnings to pay dividends with capitalized interest, which is not.
Oh, no, nobody do that.
Oh, no, nobody ever do anything like that. And so I took an old software package that I had laying around, and I sat down and ground my nose on the stone for a week or so and put it up online. I'd started originally writing on Blogger, which was Google's thing. I got very unhappy with them very fast and then went to a different package and then ultimately, you know, moved it over to my own stuff. But the thing that was interesting about that was that the, you know, that was almost entirely a purely economic phenomenon. Okay, I mean, yeah, okay, the political aspect was that the, from a standpoint of the banks in the United States, the FDIC had a legal duty under a law called prompt corrective action had a legal duty to stop them from doing this stuff, which they didn't do on purpose.
That's because they're too busy mucking out firms like mine.
Well, not only that, Chief, but in the case of IndyMac, their examiners, well, it was actually OTS. So, you know, at the time, this was when there was thrifts and there were banks, right? OTS actually...
Well, the FSLIC was involved, too.
Right. Well, OTS, you know, the thrifts were, you know, FSLIC, right? So, in the case of IndyMac, IndyMac was evading regulatory capital requirements by backdating deposits. And they ultimately blew up as a consequence of this. And
hey, hold that thought for a second, because
we just
lobbed one out there to everybody. I'm not so sure what, maybe you can educate me, what the line of demarcation is, but it used to be, if you went back 15, 20 years, the comptroller and currency was in charge of regulating the large money center banks, of which there were probably 10 at the time, and there's probably 5 now. The rest of the national banks were regulated by the Federal Reserve, and the ones that weren't, like the state banks and so forth, were regulated by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, because they're insuring deposits. They want to make sure the place had some money. And for the savings and loans, the FSLIC, which insured the deposits and the savings loan, was pretty much their regulator.
Right.
So, okay, well, go on.
Yeah.
And the state guys were involved, too.
Well, you had two three-letter agencies that were involved. You had OCC.
Yeah.
Which was the bank guys. And you had OTS.
Well, OCC's Option Clearing Corp.
Okay.
You got three letters wrong. I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, yeah. So, but then you had OTS, which was the thrift regulator guys.
Yep.
Okay. So, but in the case of IndyMac specifically, now this, at the time I started writing on this stuff, I didn't know that this was, you know, that the corruption had gone as far as it had. But when IndyMac blew up a year and a half later, what was discovered was that the way they were evading their audit, you know, because these guys all get audited, right? So the way they were evading the capital,
they probably have to pay for their own audit and then they get inspected.
Well, yeah, but I mean, you know, yeah. But there's supposedly some guys that come in and look at the books, right? That, you know, that pass on this stuff. And the way they were getting around the capital requirement was that they were backdating deposits that had come in so as to appear to have more capital.
How do you do that?
You lie. Okay, I mean, it's fraud.
Yeah, but I mean, it's right in front. I can't imagine how we could do that.
Chief, it's out and out fraud. Okay, I mean, you know, it's, you're talking about false bookkeeping entries.
Right, so I go in and I drop $500 to the teller, and they're going to say that it was there a week ago?
Yeah.
How the hell do you do that?
I don't have
enough imagination to be a billionaire, evidently.
I'm just telling you how they were doing, all right, what they were doing. Well, when they blew up, of course, you know, then the regulators come in and go and, you know, do the forensics, and this is what they find. And the thing that shocked me was that this was done with the knowledge of the examiner who was in charge of their audit. And on top of that, it was the same guy who had done it during the SNL blow-up with another institution.
Well,
okay. Now he wasn't.
Well, he took his bag of tricks to the next place.
Chief, he not only didn't get prosecuted, he didn't get fired.
He had talent.
He was a government guy. He was a government employee, and you know, here you are, right? So I mean, we have, you know, and this was the point at which I'm like, okay, you know, I'd love to leave the political aspect out of it. You can't, right? I mean, how in the hell does somebody who works for a government agency pull something like this, get away with it? I mean, you know, it costs the insurance fund huge amounts of money, all right? I mean, all these SNLs blew up in the 1980s, right?
Oh, yeah.
So, you know...
When you say blew up, Volcker blew them up. I think he did it on purpose.
Well, but remember also that Bill Black, during this period of time, was in charge of prosecuting the malfeasance that was uncovered by the blow-up. okay, of which there was a bunch, and 1,000 people went to jail.
Let's set the score here a little bit. You know, Carl, you could be, boy, if I could clone you for like a month and give you a project you could do like nobody else could do. Trace every major policy decision of the last 150 years and how all of them seem to benefit 10 banks.
Yeah.
I mean, what was going on here, the background of this was, and I was in, I took a lot of money in banking and undergrad and grad school. There used to be your regular banks. There were a lot of community banks that, you know, gave the, basically, they're all your car loans, all that kind of stuff. Now, nobody gets a car loan from a bank anymore. I mean, not nobody, but pretty damn near nobody. I walked into Lakeside one day, and I go, by the way, you guys give car loans? Well, we'd give you one, but we don't have a car loan guy anymore, but if you want one, we'll give you one. I go, okay. I've been with the guys forever, but there were things that the local banks did that other people didn't want to do. There was a pecking order on this whole stuff. But the main split was between the savings and loans and the banks. And the banks were very small on the mortgage side. And the savings and loans, I believe, 80% of their loans had to be in mortgages, right? It was like that.
Well, the entire purpose of having the split was that the S&Ls, the design, if you will, was that the money stayed in the local economy.
Right.
And so there was, rather than having a, and this got more important, of course, after the branch banking stuff all got going.
Well, it all kind of tied in. And I'd love your opinion on this, because when I was real young, I mean, my mother worked at a savings and loan. And I remember having a bank account at, First National, First Savings and Loan. And I think I got, you had your passbook when you went in and you made a deposit. By the way, the guy manually put the interest in of what your account was. But I think they paid, I'm going to say, 3.25%. And the average mortgage was probably 6.
Right.
6.25%. So the nice spread. The spread, well, spread was 2.75%, 3.
Right.
And that paid for the building, the people, the Little League uniforms. What's the spread now? 20 between what you, between a credit card and what you're getting from a bank?
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, this is the problem with any exponential function, Chief. We talk about the exponential problem that comes within the budget and things like this on a pretty regular basis around here, right?
Yeah.
And the thing is that when you allow this kind of thing to go on, it always feels like it's free at the start. All right, same thing with inflation, because that, again, is an exponential function. It's compounded. And any time that you have compounding, this is what, if you do not keep it under control, this is what happens. And, what I find so astonishing, every day you get up, you look, I'm looking at the market right now, hey, I got a bunch of green numbers. They're not really big green numbers, but they're green numbers, okay? And the indices, and the futures. And, Dow's up 60 handles. Hey, man, this is great, right?
NVIDIA's up another 80 cents. It's $20 billion in market cap.
Yeah, NVIDIA, NVIDIA's trading.
How many people know that, you think?
Well, what's
the every buck is $25 billion market cap.
Basically nobody, but here's the thing, is that it's not just there, right? I mean, Amazon, they split. How about Meta?
Well, Oracle's doubled this year.
Well, I understand this.
Even do now?
Well, Chief, Facebook was $40 all that long ago. Okay, now it's trading 700, for Christ's sakes. And the thing is, you look at this, and then I look at this all the hype over AI, okay? And technology companies and the tech side of the market always cycles through some form of hype. It happens all the time. It's common. This is what they do kind of.
Carl, it's not just technology. Technology is what, in the last 30, 40 years, this has all happened to.
Right.
But it happened... judge me on this. I'm going to lob an opinion out there. The bottom line comes when you can actually value the service versus pie-in-the-sky stuff. At first was railroads, right. TVs, radio. Oh, my God, they're going to make a gazillion dollars. And all of a sudden, the first month, you look and see, well, the train charged people X and how many trains you do a day. Once you right. can actually put a number on it, it all comes, I'll say, crashing out of the it'll be a bazillion dollars type thing. It's right. the same thing happened with kind of the cloud. I mean, Kevin, for his you know, was doing a lot of that stuff. He was working for Better World Books at the time. We were doing the show, and he goes, wait a minute, this, we're talking about other people, you being able to offload, you know, you have a more better term, your high needs time into somebody else's system, so you don't have to go buy out all the stuff. And he goes, it's already very competitive. Right. There's, it's not, I mean, he goes, yeah, some people have an advantage because they're already in the place. Maybe, you know, maybe the Amazon or somebody. He goes, they have a little bit of an advantage. But still, he goes, I have five or six vendors. It's not going to be people are going to pay everything that they're willing to pay. Same thing happened to railroads. Same thing happened to TV. And the same thing probably someday somebody like you is going to say, this is what this AI is really worth to these people. And by the way, you thought it was worth $90 bazillion. It's going to be worth something. I mean, it's probably worth very accretive. It's worth this. And when that day happens, all of a sudden people can value it. And maybe it'll be too high, maybe it won't. But that's when it all comes kind of crashing to earth, let's say. Maybe down, maybe up. But to me, that's when it all happens. You know, when can you really value eBay?
This is the basic problem you have with this right now is that, you know, things, when you get into a paradigm where it goes up because it went up yesterday, right?
The word is momentum trading.
Well, I understand this, but I mean, when you boil it down, all right, I mean, you know, people love to use fancy words, right? But the truth is, the reason it's that the market is up six, you know, that you're up six handles today is because it was up yesterday, right? And the thing is that I get up in the morning and it's like I said back in the 07, 08 time frame. I said, look, every single day, you know, as somebody who's been trading since, you know, back when I was running my internet company, I frequently had a console open where I had some extra time. I was doing some of this stuff because even though I didn't have specific information on specific companies, I had sector knowledge because that was what I did. Okay, that was my job. I was running a company in that sector. So I had sector knowledge, and the sector knowledge meant that I could take a look at what somebody was doing, look at this IPO and say, okay, this is a load of horse bleep, right? And I don't want to be anywhere near that crap. Oh, by the way, I got an allocation. Well, guess what? I just sold that and doubled my money. Even though it was a small allocation, it doubles a double, right? and oh, by the way, you know, they'll call me and they'll yell at me about it. But the thing is, because they don't want you to flip it. But at the end of the day, they're still going to call me and give me the allocation the next time we're going to put the bid on it.
By the way, when I used to lecture a lot, when my brother would go, one of my first slides was market risk.
Right.
And the first one, by the way, you just described number two. The first one is general market risk. Just if you're in anywhere, interest rates go down 5 points, go up 5 points, no matter where you are, you're probably going to be affected unless you've got like the world's crummiest stock or the world's best stock. The next one is, I used to call it industry risk, but sector risk. All of a sudden, oil goes to the moon, those guys go to the sky. And the third one is individual company risk.
Right.
You know, those are really the three levels of risk.
Right, right. And the thing is that market risk in general, you do not have much control over. Okay, I mean, you know, you can buy insurance against it to some extent. Right, you know, I mean, right now, if you want to buy some puts, you know, VIX is at 16.5. Hey, that ain't so expensive, right?
Well, you can't be, even if you're a futures trader, which you used to think was probably, well, you're always the slave of government estimates for like corn and beans and stuff. Remember beaks and the orange juice thing.
Oh yeah.
But still, you would think that the politics are not all that much in there until the tariffs the first time and soybeans, you know, Trump's first term. You know, right. We had all the soybean issues and whatever. But now this time, I have never seen, in all the years I've been here, I've never seen anything like this tariff on copper. Where
copper historically has been, I mean, you used to call it Dr. Copper.
It's been it's taken 10 years to go from $4 to $5, and it went to $5.60 in a nanosecond, and it's a 25,000 pound contract.
Right.
So 60 cents is what? $12,000?
Yeah, that's
on a one lot. That's a real number.
On a one lot, yeah.
That's a real number.
Small.
So now, yeah. I mean, I have people listen. I've had a lot of clients. This is not all just me. Not wanted to be part of the general market. We've been in the metals. We've been in silver and gold for a while because it's used to be more of an inflation play, and you know we weren't doing so hot for a while. But now this year we've done very well in there. Now I'm sitting there going, I'm not selling. I don't think. Even Trump is going to put a tariff on gold, but I'm not so sure that I'm not selling any calls of silver.
Yeah.
I mean, silver could. Well, I mean, for those that copper is essentially an industrial metal, gold is, they use it for some industry, and silver is kind of a blend in the middle, right?
Yeah. Silver is, you know, the thing that is interesting is that silver's definitionally changed over, you know, over the last 30 or 40 years, because it used to be that a great deal of the production was used in photographic film.
Yep.
Where it's absolutely indispensable. Of course, who
shoots? Well, it's silver, silver nitrate, right?
Well, yeah, but yeah. That's an essential part of the emulsion, okay, that produces the image. However, who uses film cameras anymore, right? I mean, it's all digital now.
Well, I know a lot of people that are still into it.
Well, but, you know, I mean, there's, boy, oh boy, I'll tell you, you know, it's a niche thing, whereas it used to be everybody with an Instamatic, right, was
my buddy, old. My buddy John Lee brought a guy from Singapore over, real, real nice guy. Boy, he had a Hasselblad and a Leica. He was carting around taking all these pictures of the Art Institute in Chicago and everything. The guy last night was telling me he's got a one-bedroom apartment. He just somehow cordoned off the apartment where 10 by 10 of it was a film studio.
I had a dark room in my basement when I was a kid.
Wow.
Okay. I did my own processing.
Before break, I have a totally off the wall question for you. The other night I was saying, where the hell's Carl? I could use him here. And I even buy him a drink. I was in the local emporium, and one of my friends who owns what do you call them? Waste metal facility. You bring crummy old metal there, and recycler.
Yeah.
And he was telling me they got broken into.
Yeah.
And I go, well, what did they steal? He goes, gold and copper. I go, what do you mean gold and copper? I mean, I know people. In a washing machine, you're going to get a bunch of copper wires. I get that part. I go, where the hell do you get the gold? He's all, we recycle servers.
Electronics.
We pull all the stuff out and we send the motherboard someplace. He goes, the gold's real, it's real dirty. I mean, it's still, we send it to some other place. It's probably 40% gold and other kind of crummy metal in there, but there's gold there. I mean, it's definitely, so somebody else will find a way to extract it and make it, you know, real gold. He goes, yeah, we all. I'm sorry, how much gold is in a regular server sitting in front of me in my office? I mean, I'm sure there's copper in there. I think I said it was like a hundredth of an ounce or something. I went on YouTube.
Yeah, it's a tiny amount, but the thing is that on the, so you have, so there's a couple of places where it's utterly essential. So if we, as an example, you have the pins on your processor, okay? Modern machines, for the most part, are socketed, and there's a zero insertion force. The way that the sockets work is rather interesting, and that's like a bunch of pins, okay? Literally, like pins, okay? With very sharp edges. God help you if you damage it. It's unrepairable because the pitch is so fine that you can't possibly unscrew it, essentially, right? So, I mean, the board's trash if you do that. But the contacts on those, the contacts on the CPUs, and internally within the chips, you have the same sort of situation, because the flow of electricity, you know, the what you have to understand about electricity is that any resistance dissipates some of the power as heat, and heat is the enemy of electronics. It is the limiting factor in switching speed within CPUs, and ultimately the biggest problem that you have trying to make machines run faster and more efficient is that you have, every time you switch power, some of it is lost as heat, because the laws of thermodynamics aren't suggestions. You can't cheat them. And as a result, this is why we now, if you look at like the core operating voltage in a modern CPU, it's under 1 volt. It's like 7/10 or half a volt, or, you know, I mean, it's extremely low. Same thing, like your average operating voltage for modern memory is like 1 volt, 1.2 volts. And you'd say, but wait a minute, like the common operating voltage for most electronics for years has been five volts. Okay, your car runs on 12, but all the operating electronics and most things is five.
They used to run on 6.
Yeah, well, but the reason that voltage has come down so much in modern computer technology is because that's how you get the power dissipation down. But again, now you start getting into the problem, well, you better have very, very low resistance connections. And gold is one of the best conductors that is out there. And on top of that, it doesn't oxidize. It's an inert material. And as a result, because it doesn't have an oxidation problem, that connection in terms of its resistance is very stable over time. And that's essential for these things to work. So that's that's the reason it's there. They use as little as they can, but yeah, they're.
But how do you? If I want to crunch up a server, how the hell would I get it out? A little bit that's there.
Well, that's So this is part of the problem, is that the processes required to do that, you know, because gold is chemically inert, you can use all sorts of really nasty chemicals to dissolve everything else. And what you get left, what's left, is the gold.
Okay.
This is a serious problem from a standpoint of ecology. A lot of this recycling is actually done over in China, where they don't care about environmental laws and they don't care about the disposal.
Well, he tells me that they send different things to different places, and people specialize in it.
Yes, it is a highly specialized thing. The equipment is expensive, the processing is expensive, environmental compliance is outrageously expensive in the United States. In many cases, it's actually cheaper to ship stuff back over to China and have them do it there, where they don't care about the environment. But yes, and so, you know, I mean, this is one of the realities of it, is that there is, in a server or in a disk drive or in a whatever, there is a tiny
amount.
Well,
we got to dash the break, but how do you get the copper out of wire? Is there something that dissolves the covering?
Or you burn it off, and then you just, you know, you melt it and then fractionate off the melt from the standpoint of the metal.
Yeah, our SP futures up 4 and SP futures up 8. We were more last night, but we're just kind of cruising here right now. We'll be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Howe, Ricky on the board. SP Futures up 575. NASDAQ Futures up 1275. We've got... let's see what kind of stocks we got going. We got Chevron Texaco up 586. Tri-Means Oil's up a little bit. We'll talk about that. We have 3M, which actually had earnings, up 446, or up 3%. I think the straddle was like 7, so we're kind of within. Netflix is now down 33.67. I think the straddle was like 80. But the stock's trading 1240. I've got those guys Carl, I think at about a 13, 14, maybe 15 times revenue, which is kind of high to me. Obviously, sure. The rest of the world now thinks that's okay now. We've got Ricky. Why don't you do traffic, weather, sports, and I'll kick my computer. Oh, I got it. European shares tick higher, they say, as earnings hold the spotlight. Yeah, I don't think they're higher. Why don't you do traffic, weather, sports, and then we'll come back to this.
Absolutely. Good morning, Chief. It's currently 7:35 a.m. here in Chicago. We got 64 degrees right now with a high of 76. It's nice with sunshine and a few clouds today. Tonight will be humid with increasing amounts of clouds. A thunderstorm is spots towards dawn with a low of 70 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 88 degrees right now with a high of 107. Partly sunny and very warm. A thunderstorm is spots this afternoon. Tonight, another thunderstorm warning. Otherwise, mainly clear with a low of 86 degrees. Traffic in Chicago, inbound Kennedy from Monroe's, we got 20 minutes. Inbound Edens from Lane Cook, 33 minutes. Inbound Eisenhower from Wolf, 29 minutes. We're looking at 15 minutes. Inbound Dan Ryan from 95th. And lastly, inbound Stevenson from 294 to the Dan Ryan, 25 minutes. Real quick, MLB, Red Sox at Cubs today at 1:20 p.m. White Sox at Pirates, 5:40 p.m. And Cardinals at Diamondbacks, 8:40 p.m. Back over to you, Chief.
Dax down 56.2%. FTSE up 16.2%. CAC around up 3, call that flat. So let's say it's the Friday snoozer over there in Europe. Australian stocks, record high. Where's Rita Coolidge? We need her. We're on an all-time high. Nikkei down 82.2%. Hang Seng up 326, 1.3%. They've been pretty strong lately. Shanghai up 17.5. We've got bonds. This is the one that, you know, nobody wants to watch, but I've been watching. 10-year is 4.43. The Bund is 2.69, up 2 basis points. But the 30-year... Well, 30 years now, a little under 5, 4.994, and I think if that thing makes it through 5 and makes some damage toward 5.5 or 6, we got a little bit of a problem, especially with Trump wanting to can Powell and all this other stuff. Oil up $1.37, that's why you saw Chevron Texaco, but still under 70, 68.91, Brent up 121, 70.73. Carl, hold his thought, why is heating oil spiking when oil is not? Gold's up 17.90. 33.63, silver up 39 cents, 38.70. What do you, for those that don't, I mean, this is very rough, but if you have a barrel of oil, if you have 3 barrels of oil, you end up with what, 2 barrels of gasoline roughly, and one barrel of heating oil plus some other crap, right? Isn't that the ratio?
Yeah, sort of that. And you can shift it some with a catalytic unit. A
little bit.
But not a huge amount. So, I mean, there's some exchange that can go on there. But pretty much, you know, the split, you know, the crack is the crack is the crack, right? I mean, you know, you can
monkey with a little, but it gets expensive to do that, doesn't it?
You could actually monkey, you know, the Germans showed us that, World War II, that you can monkey with it whatever degree you want. And Fischer-Tropsch is a process that is known to work. It's how they managed to make their fuel that they needed for the war, because Germany had basically no oil. And, of course, as soon as people started shooting each other, they got embargoed by everybody, right? But they had a lot of coal. And so, I mean, the problem isn't can you do it. The problem is how expensive is it? And the answer is very, when you want to come off of what normally would come out of the straight run from the refinery. So, as you deviate from where it wants to go, the cost goes vertical, and it's just not worth doing. My suspicion, Chief, on the fuel oil thing, realize that heating oil is the same thing as number two diesel.
Right.
Okay. So what you're really seeing is, and this is. We screwed with this back in the 07-ish time frame. Prior to that, there was a pattern that was every year, for very good reason, which was that in the summertime, diesel was very cheap. It was cheaper than gasoline, cheaper than regular gasoline. So if you had a diesel vehicle, summer is when most of us schlubs go enjoy vacations and things, right? During the winter, we're working. Our kids are in school, whatever have you. So you got a nice bonus, and on top of that, being that there's more energy content in diesel than there is in gasoline, you had better fuel economy. So in the summer, which is when you would care about this for long vacations, your fuel costs to go take them in a diesel-powered vehicle went down a lot. And in the winter, it went up. Why? Well, because guess what? We use some of that for heating oil, especially in the Northeast. And, of course, there's no heating demand in the middle of August.
Yeah, and you don't use it for AC like you do.
Right,
well, exactly. Some utilities still use oil.
But not much.
Not much.
But then, in the mid part of the 2000 time frame, right around the time of the crash and then forward, we started exporting very large amounts of diesel, of number two heating oil.
When did the law change? We couldn't export refined products for a long, long time. Was that like 10 years ago, 15, we could?
I don't know precisely when it changed, but I'll tell you, the economics of, I mean, I bought a diesel-powered car, a 03 Jetta. My daughter has it now. And one of the reasons I bought it was because of this shift in that we like to travel a lot in the summertime when school is out and all this. And the thing gets 50 miles a gallon. Okay. So, I mean, and you're going to sell me the fuel for less than it costs me for me to buy regular gas.
And it bounces back and forth above or beyond unleaded gas a little bit.
Well, it used to. Well, now it's consistently more expensive than gas.
Used to be consistently less, a lot less, way
well,
back.
Well, not in the winter. In the winter.
I'm talking 40 years ago, it was always less.
Oh, yeah. But see, it's just, it's a supply and demand thing, which, everybody says, oh, no, there's no such thing as supply and demand. It only applies when we want it to. It's not the universal law of economics.
Carl, gasoline is 42 gallons in a barrel. Gasoline, approximately 19 to 20 gallons.
Yep.
Distillate fuel, including diesel, 11 to 13. Jet fuel, 3 to 4. And then you got the other crap, lubricants and grade 5 and all that stuff.
Well, jet fuel is basically kerosene.
Okay.
Is essentially what it is. All right? I mean, there's other stuff in it, but the essence of it is it's kerosene.
Okay.
So that's a very light crack that comes off. Which is lighter than
how much different I know. I mean, I'm no oil engineer, but how much difference does the type of oil? When I say that, if everyone wants to get an education, of course, I don't know how many people really want an education. Look and see how many oil contracts there are worldwide. There's all kinds of them. I mean here, it's the what are we? We're Texas, what are we, Texas Light number 2 or
West Texas Intermediate is the WTI is the common one.
But now there's all kinds of different things.
Right.
That was the whole issue, and don't take this wrong, but the right wingers are still bitching and moaning about that pipeline. Okay, that pipeline was a specific type of oil coming from the tar sands, which is not, hence the name tar sands. It's all kind of sand. It's a bunch of crap, but it's oil. It's also very similar, I think, to the Venezuelan oil. Correct?
Or
is it the Saudi? Anyway, the refineries are set up for a certain type of oil.
Right. The problem is you can't just take one and shove it in the other.
No. Well, you could probably take West Texas and put it anywhere, but the stuff we're talking about has to be heated just to flow.
Right.
And there were a couple of refineries in Texas that somehow, if it was Venezuela or Saudi or somebody that gives you this, crappy sandy stuff, they were designed for that, and because we weren't importing from them anymore, which makes me think it was Venezuela, they're kind of, bleep out of luck. So the idea was to make it easier for this tar sands, which still has oil in it, I mean, it's got value, and get it to the refineries that were set up to doing it that aren't doing butkus. So I think it was a pretty good idea, but there was no spinoff to the refinery in Bolingbrook here or the one in Whiting, Indiana, because nobody wants that. But there were a couple.
Well, they would have if that's what they were running before.
But they're not about to change that. So there's all kinds of this different stuff, and I have to believe if you got the real heavy crap, you're not getting 20 gallons a barrel out of that, are you? I don't think.
Well, you probably are, but the thing is that part of the reason you can't just, you know, say, well, I'm going to run this time and that the next time or whatever, is that the pressure and temperature requirements are wildly different between them. And so the equipment, in some cases, it's not something that can be adjusted for. In some cases, you actually would have to rebuild the refinery.
Well, that's when they had the hurricane. It had nothing to do with, well, helped didn't help. The wind hitting the refinery, it cut the power.
Yeah.
And if you've got this kind of crap going through your pipes, they have to be heated. So
right.
every horizontal pipe essentially had to be cut out. You don't just turn the heat back on and stuff starts flowing. They had to cut all those pipes out and redo them, right?
There's all sorts of really bad things that happen if you have an uncontrolled shutdown in a plant like that. Yeah, it's...
get a load of this, Carl. When I was doing my stuff for the... when I was very young, you know, we were young, you and I, once in a while, once way back. I was all in these different public schools. Well, a couple of them were coal-fired still with the pumps that were all high pressure. We're talking... pressure was 200 pounds of you know, an inch, which is, you know, dangerous as hell. If you see that steam coming out, if you wing your arm across it, it'd cut your arm off, right?
Oh yeah.
And they was all high pressure steam, and one of the schools was an oil boiler, and they used grade 5, which is slightly more viscous than asphalt. Asphalt's what, probably 7 or something. So it had to come in a heated truck. You pumped it into the tank, and the tank it wasn't heated to, you know, 200 degrees, but if you put your hand on it, it was heated to probably 80, 85, just to keep the stuff moving. And when you started the boiler up, you had another tank that had what you're talking about, diesel heating oil,
right,
in there, and you'd start the flame with that. And then they had these little, it was almost like, what do they call the things in the diesel motor that spits out the little bit of diesel, the real tiny drops.
Oh, you mean the ejectors?
The ejectors. Well, yeah, this thing had these ejectors, and it would force this gook through there, and you'd end up with these little tiny pellets, maybe the size of how small it could be, go into the fire and then kind of explode in the fire into flame. It's the only way you get that. If you throw a match in a tank, the match would go out. There was no.
Well, that's true for diesel generally.
Yeah.
It doesn't volatilize.
No, this is the number 5 stuff. It was like gook.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, this. So there's been this huge shift in shipping as well. Okay, this is another thing.
Is that what they call bunker oil, number 5?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if that's technically in the category of bunker fuel, but probably is. So you have with ships, the diesels that drive the ships are typically, there is no transmission, it's directly coupled. Okay, so, you know, comes out of the back end of the engine and there's the shaft.
It's direct drive, literally.
Direct drive, yeah, it's direct drive, for real, all right? So when they want to reverse, they actually stop the engine, start it running the other way. But these are, you know, we're talking about huge. I mean, the size of these engines is unbelievable. They're the primary, you know, motivating unit. And their RPMs are so low that they directly will burn bunker fuel. They don't have any problem with it because the combustion is much slower. But that's perfectly fine when you've got a, you know, you've got a piston that's 2 feet in diameter.
Except for the big black belt of smoke coming out of the ship.
Well, okay, so what's happened is that IMO, which is the International Maritime Organization, it regulates all this stuff. You first had countries that said, when you're within our EEZ, you can't burn that stuff.
Yeah, we have that here. Was it 12 miles? You got to go on to something else?
Well, so you had to burn regular diesel, okay. Well, a diesel engine, for the most part, doesn't care. Of course, the fuel system's different. You have to change the fuel system around. But they'll run on virtually anything. And so as long as, you know, you're talking about these great big things. So part of the shift in what's happened with the demand is that you now have, IMO has come in and essentially gotten rid of, for the most part, to a large degree, the burning of this higher sulfur, much less refined bunker fuel, This has driven up the cost of running the engines because the more refined the fuel is, the more
it... Yeah, but you only have to use it for the last 12 miles in or something, don't you?
Well, not entirely. Now this has changed, you know, on a global basis to a large degree. The emissions requirements have gotten much more stringent over time as new ships. Now the old ones can continue to be used, but you know, when you build a new one, you can't do it with the older technology anymore. There's a couple of things that are kind of interesting about this. One of the things that's happened is that as they've done this, the reduction in smoke has actually resulted in a detectable shift towards hotter in temperatures.
That does not surprise me.
So you know what? We claim that we humans are such terrible beasts and we're ruining the planet by emitting carbon. Well, actually cleaning up the shipping industry, which we have done to a large degree, has done the exact terrible evil thing that everyone...
Well, they finally mothballed or did something to the ferry up in Milwaukee. It was coal.
Yeah.
Well, they used to dump the clinkers and all the stuff from the coal in the lake.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it's there's everything has a reaction, but from an economic standpoint, if you're wondering why it is that we've had this, you know, this relationship that used to be there forever with diesel fuel and gasoline, and it's, you know, it's inverted now, it's gone the other way. That's part of the reason, is that now you have shipping demand that's driving diesel, where for the most part, until 15, 20 years ago, there was essential. I mean,
well, could there be any
stuff at all?
How many? Well, I got two things. We only have 10 minutes, but two things I absolutely talk to you about. Is heating oil? Do we still have places that use that for utilities?
I don't know what's still out there in terms of mainline energy production, simply because it's not economic. Where there may be, if it has to be delivered by pipe, I would think that anybody with a brain in their head has converted that to gas.
Okay.
I can't imagine you wouldn't do it if there's a pipe that delivers it. Now, you know, of course, where it becomes a problem is there's no pipe, right? Same sort of situation. I mean, the Northeast, to a large degree, people used heating oil. Well, hell, the house I grew up in was oil heat. Okay.
Well, there's a lot of places in the city. The first move you make is you didn't get rid of the old coal furnace. You put oil grates in the coal furnace. Is what happened here.
Well, we had oil heat. We had an oil burner.
Was it originally coal?
No.
It was okay.
No,
just plain
oil. It wasn't a great system. It was a high pressure, had a pump, like an injection pump. All right. But the minute that the city brought piped gas into the street, Dad paid to run it into the house and threw the old furnace out and converted it because it was much less expensive to operate.
Well, I see my grandfather had not done that yet. His place he had, it was a two flat, and you could see it was a coal furnace, coal boiler, whatever you want to call it, and they had converted it. They had the huge oil tank in there, and they took the coal grates out and put essentially some oil burners and just used the same system with the pumps for the radiators and all that stuff. But, hey, two things. One is, real quick, because we could talk forever on it, the valuation and the thing that, that is embedded in the head of my head is because, I mean, that's what I do this for people, and I talk to people about stock prices and stuff. I mean,
right.
I mean, when we were down in the Bahamas, I was telling Kevin how much I didn't like it down there, but
yeah.
the stock of the day, the stock du jour of the 70 people who were in the room was Micron.
Oh, God.
And Micron was straight. How many times has Micron gone from like 100 to 6 to back again? And Micron's like 95.
Right.
And I said, okay, how many in here have Micron? And like out of the 60, like 45 hands go up. And I said, it's 95. I'm not going to say whether it's too high, too low. That's not my job, man. But you're the guys that own it. What has to happen this weekend while we're down at the Bahamas eating conch and sucking on drinks with umbrellas? What What has to happen for Monday morning, you roll over and you say, Lucy, it's enough. Is it 110, 120, 140? And one hand went up, it's just going higher. I said, yeah. What if I were to say to you right now, no, I don't have a scratch for this, but I'm going to give you 120 for it right now. Another hand goes up. That just proves it, Chief. You're trying to steal it from us. You know it's really worth 150.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there going, well, it couldn't have been a month later, Carl, that it was 7 or something. I mean, it was like...
Yeah.
Now, I see some of this stuff now. It looks to me, and the one I always use is revenue per share, not earnings. I think some of these stocks are 20, 30, 40% higher than they were in 2000.
And some are even more.
Yeah.
Right? I mean,
Fed, instead of pulling money back, is putting money in, so that's a factor, right?
Yeah, but you know what? Here's the thing. Like what we saw, you know, this week we've gotten some economic data, right? So, you know, some consumer-related economic data. And the Martz report was out yesterday. Right? And, I mean, it got 30 seconds worth of mention on CNBS, and then, you know, they were off to something else. Okay, so if you look at this on this is one of the ones Census twists the knobs on because they have their seasonal adjusted stuff, right? But Martz does not adjust for inflation. It's dollars, just like GDP is in dollars, okay? All right, fine. But you take a look at this on a headline basis, year over year, and it is well below the federal deficit.
Explain what Martz is.
Martz is the retail sales report.
Okay,
Martz is what Census calls it, and it comes out every month, and it's broken down by categories. So you've got all items less cars.
But there's no deflator in it.
There's no deflator in it. All right, so it's in today's dollars. It's stated in today's dollars. And one of the things that actually makes it fairly useful is that it's broken down by categories. And one of the major categories is non-store retailers, which is shorthand for Amazon.
Yep.
Okay.
Well, what is the huge amount that you get from, you know, auto parts stores and you know the stuff from Walmart and stuff? Is that all in the Walmart pot, or is that broken out in this other pot?
Well, it depends. So, like automobiles and parts. Okay, so you have, you know, you have cars, and then you have parts related stuff. But it's retail sales. Okay, so you have total. Then you have total excluding motor vehicles and parts. Then you have total excluding gas stations, and then total excluding motor vehicles, parts, and gas stations. Okay, so that's kind of in the, you know, the gasoline thing. That they break that out is actually, you know, gasoline stations, which would include diesel in a gasoline, because it's the station, it's not the type of fuel, is actually kind of useful that gets broken out separately, because, you know, if you look at this, you know, gasoline down, percent change over 2024 is down 4%, but that's not gallons, that's dollars, and gas prices have come down, okay? So you have to be a little careful looking at this, but if you take, you know, that out, excluding gasoline stations, excluding motor vehicles and parts and gasoline stations, you're up 4% annualized. Okay, well, we got a 6.7% fiscal acceleration from deficit spending as a percentage of GDP. So, this means that in real dollar terms, consumer spending is down about 2.
Well, okay. Well, let's argue about that one on Tuesday, because I want to push back here on that, because if any of it is done through borrowing, you didn't add to it. You just sucked it from one end and put it some other place.
Well, okay. That makes it even worse.
Yeah.
Right, hey, yes.
We'll fight this one on Tuesday. What is the story with... Did you see the Westinghouse article in a big poobah meeting?
Oh,
with Trump?
Yeah. Okay.
Well, this is Westinghouse. Boy, I thought that name was gone, but evidently they put the last two nuclear facilities that were built, big huge things down in Georgia. Right. They went $7.5 billion over budget, bankrupted the company. Well, now they're owned by somebody else, and they're coming back, and they've just cut a deal with the president, supposedly, building 10 more of these big monster reactors, each one of which can handle 750,000 houses. I mean, it's huge. I mean,
yeah.
And I saw that, and I said, where the hell's Carl when I need him? Now, no mention of the smaller, newer types. So I read this, and I go, here's a company went under putting this kind of plant together. Now they want to do 10 more of them. I'm going, did John Wayne fall off his horse again in the same movie? Or what? I mean, you know, you wonder, they think they got it right this time?
There is fairly substantial set of design differences between a modern BWR, PWR, and the stuff that was put in 4 years ago.
Well, this one, the one just started up 6 months ago or whatever.
No, I understand that. I'm just saying that, you know, I mean, as time has gone on, there have been improvements, but the basic thermodynamics of a water moderated reactor, no matter what kind it is, can't be changed because the efficiency is governed by the laws of thermodynamics. You can't get any. It is what it is. The problem you have generally with nuclear power is that the overhead rate, if you will, because the reactor is, in the grand scheme of things, a pretty small piece of the total overall plant. Right? I mean, it's basically a tea kettle when you think about it. It's all the other stuff and all of the overhead involved in handling the fuel and the waste, the water plant testing that has to be done in terms of the boilers and everything else. Those costs are an extraordinarily large part of the whole. And so the whole small modular reactor concept sounds good. The problem with it from a penciling standpoint is, to a large degree, what you're doing is shoving that under the carpet for the 3 or 5 years that its fuel load is good for, and then all of a sudden there's this back end cost to deal with it that has it's not part of the calculation. With these conventional plants, it is, because they cycle the fuel when they shut down for refueling. They have a spent fuel pool, all that stuff's on site. And that's all a known, because we've been doing this for a pretty long period of time now, right? So, I mean, this is not a new thing at all. These SMRs, all of that is I wouldn't say it's an unknowable set of costs.
Well, Tuesday, let's walk through the sodium one you're talking about. Ignored. Yeah, you walk through the sodium ones and stuff. Because I was kind of surprised. These things are monsters. The idea that a firm would want to build 10 of the same thing and just broke them. I guess you learn. There's a learning curve there somewhere, but still, I'd sit there and go, wait a minute, I better price it right this time.
Well, Chief, if you stop people from suing every time, putting three times the cost of the plant into lawsuit defense and bullshit like this, then I think you actually would have something that would be a whole lot more viable.
Well, I'm with you on that. Anyway, SP Futures up 8, NASDAQ is up 24. Carl, have a nice weekend. Back on Monday. Yep. Ricky, nice job. Back on Monday. Stocks and Jacks.
That's all, folks.